Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Joining us now, as they do on most Fridays, are Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader, and Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. This week, Attorney General Bill Schuette issued a legal opinion that poor-performing schools in Detroit can be closed at the end of the year, which runs counter to what Governor Snyder's office has been saying. The Snyder administration concluded that since the schools are part of a newly created district, they'd have 3 years before the state could step in and close the worst-performing schools. Ken, is this another example of the Attorney General and the governor at odds? What's going on here?
It is, but I can't understand for the life of me why the governor would have put himself in this position, because an opinion from the Attorney General basically binds state agencies unless it's overturned. The governor's relying on a legal opinion offered by a private law firm. I don't understand why he didn't go to the Attorney General first and why he would put himself in this, I think, extremely awkward position at this point in time. It's a mystery to me.
Susan, it's been suggested in reports that Attorney General Bill Schuette is doing the bidding of the DeVos family, which has given Schuette campaign funds a substantial support over the year, and that family supports charter schools. What do you make of those suggestions?
I think that it's very hard to draw a straight line. Certainly the charter lobby, the education choice lobby, and the DeVos family, they've all been very big fans of Governor Snyder as well, and many politicians in the state, mostly on the Republican side, not exclusively. And, you know, for those of us who cover the inside part of politics, there are actually a lot of tensions between Attorney General Bill Schuette and the DeVos family, and it's kind of an open secret that they would like an alternative candidate to run against Bill Schuette in 2018 for governor.
Ken, I want to do a quick follow-up on what you said. You know, it is traditional that the Attorney General is the governor, or the whole state's counsel, basically, on these things. Has anybody given any suggestion why he would go to an outside counsel instead of the Attorney General?
If they have, I'm not aware of it and what the argument would be, but why would you go to an outside counsel first, make the opinion public, say you're going to rely on that opinion, and then without even going to the Attorney General because of the potential of this in fact occurring, where the Attorney General issues a counter opinion, which has the force of law? I just do not understand the thinking, if there was any, that would put the governor in this kind of spot.
Let's turn to Washington. Without an agreement, the federal government could have run out of money. One of the sticking points to a stopgap measure was money for Flint to help the city recover from the lead contamination of its drinking water. Susan, I wonder if you could explain why money for Flint was an issue in this spending measure.
Well, it's been a very sad development that it's been so difficult to get money to Flint from Congress, and it certainly has not been a priority. With us heading into a potential government shutdown this week, I think Democrats saw an opening to advocate for the cause. And although it didn't actually make it into the stopgap measure, there have been agreements that Flint will get funding in measures that will be taken up after the election.
Ken, there was an argument about the natural disaster that happened in Louisiana versus the man-made disaster that happened in Flint, and that was the concern of the Republicans. Could you explain that a little further for us?
No, because it's a distinction without a difference in this case. This argument, well, the flooding in Louisiana was not man-made, and the Flint water contamination was, and so therefore Flint doesn't get assistance, but Louisiana does. Well, it just doesn't pass the smell test. Both disasters, both need help. And I think what this indicates is you're going to need some federal assistance across the country to deal with this lead service line issue.
Finally, newspapers across the nation are publishing their endorsements of presidential candidates. The Detroit News decided to endorse Libertarian Gary Johnson. And as the paper wrote, quote, "Today, this newspaper does something it has never done in its 143-year history, endorse someone other than the Republican candidate as a presidential contest. Ken, what's this say about this election year?
Well, the Detroit News is not the only Republican-leaning newspaper to do this. It's happened in, I think, Arizona and Ohio. USA Today just recently said they've never gotten involved in a presidential race in terms of endorsement, but now they're saying don't vote for Trump. But these Republican newspapers, are all saying the same thing as the news did, that at least in their opinion, Donald Trump is erratic, he's unstable. And in fact, the news said that he employs reckless rhetoric. And if you go through all these editorials from these Republican newspapers, they all say the same thing. They're very, very concerned about the Republican nominee. It says more about Trump than it does about the newspaper.
Susan, the timing was interesting. Wednesday, MSNBC held a town hall meeting with Gary Johnson. He was asked to name a world leader he respected, and he couldn't recall a single name. That made the endorsement even more interesting, or the timing of the endorsement, although I assume the editorial was written before that gaffe. What do you think the loyal readers of the Detroit News are thinking now?
The editorial was written before that interview, but even if you look at some of Gary Johnson's interviews, especially in Foreign Affairs, to the Detroit News editorial board, it's rather clear that he does not have a grasp of foreign policy. So I was a little surprised to see them go down that road. I never expected that the news would endorse Hillary Clinton. I think Nolan Finley, the editorial page editor, would rather stab his eyes out with a fork than do so. They've gotten hits from both conservative and liberal readers. Liberal readers pointing out that Johnson does not know the name of world leaders and isn't serious. And conservative readers really feel betrayed because the news is known as a Republican editorial board paper, and they feel that they should have done their duty and endorsed the nominee, who is Donald Trump.
That's Susan Demas. She is publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Hey, thanks, and have a good weekend.
Thanks, Lester.
Thanks.
A new opera premiered in Michigan's Upper Peninsula last night. The composer, Eugene Berman, says the opera needs to engage a wider audience. And to do that, it needs to break free from some of the traditions and confines of places like New York and Chicago. The Juilliard-trained musician also wants opera to address issues that are relevant today, not 200 years ago. From our partners at Interlochen Public Radio, Dan Wanschura reports.
Last summer, I met Eugene Berman and his librettist, Scott Diehl, on an island in the middle of Lake Superior. They were working on their new opera called State of the Union.
Pretty much everything that Scott and I have attempted to do in every genre that we've worked in, we've tried to sort of ask the question of why does it have to be this way? Can it be different? I think in most cases, people have responded in a way that's saying, well, yeah, I guess it can be.
State of the Union is different. There are no fancy costumes, no pit orchestra, just 12 singers, a drummer, and the occasional use of a megaphone. Last night they debuted it in Marquette at the Forrest Roberts Theater at Northern Michigan University. Niels Schweikendieck is the director of the Helsinki Chamber Choir, the group that will perform the opera on its U.S. tour. He says actual singing is probably less than half of what they perform in this contemporary opera.
We're whistling, we're speaking, we're shouting, we're whispering, we're breathing.
State of the Union is an opera about the environment and how people interact with it. It portrays four characters: the environment, the wealthy elite, the middle class, and the disenfranchised lower class.
It's a discussion between characters about critical issues that the world is facing today, that we're facing today.
That's Scott Diehl, the librettist.
And more importantly, how these characters interact with each other. How do we treat each other? Do we respect each other? And do we value one another?
Eugene Berman says there can be meaningful public dialogue about the environment. But eventually, he says it degenerates to the point where people just talk over each other.
So the opera is going to mimic that by just repeating it over and over again until it becomes impossible to understand what's being said. And then we get some sort of conclusion from it. But we need to have that degeneration of conversation to understand that we need a conclusion.
Yeah. Berman says the classic operas we know today were politically and socially relevant for their time. But he says the issues people were facing hundreds of years ago are considerably different than what we face today. Berman believes opera can still be relevant, but it needs to be more than just about music. He says it's easier to get away from those traditions and formalities of opera in a place like Marquette. The show is in Marquette this week, thanks in part to the help of Melissa Matusak-Allen. She's the director of the Art Museum at Northern Michigan University. She went to grad school in Chicago, but it never occurred to her to buy a ticket to the opera. She says it didn't feel accessible.
I came at it originally as, it's a bourgeois entertainment that people get dressed up and they go and have fancy dinners and then they make a night of it.
But Melissa says opera as a way to have political discussions does make sense, especially if the discussion is about man's relationship with nature and happening in a place like Marquette.
People in the Upper Peninsula understand that. We all have, a really interesting relationship with nature. It's what keeps a lot of us here.
State of the Union will continue to tour Northern Michigan, and we'll finish with a show in New York. For Stateside, I'm Dan Wanshura.
That is not from The Onion. Dan Wanshura hosts the Green Room for Interlochen Public Radio. You can find the show's podcast on iTunes. Still to come, a neglected Jewish cemetery in Detroit gets a new lease on life. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Think about this. What if you were given the chance to vote on where your city spends its money? There are many cities doing exactly that. People in the community annually choose whether to spend money fixing sidewalks or paving streets, putting up an art installation, or maybe sprucing up a park. It's called participatory budgeting. This week, officials from Cambridge, Massachusetts budget department are in Michigan talking with Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor officials about how it works. Cambridge started using participatory budgeting a couple of years ago. Michelle Monsignor is one of those Cambridge officials, and she joins us now. So tell me a little bit more about how participatory budgeting works.
Sure. Well, thank you for having us on the program, and thank you to our host, Janine DeLay from A2 Access, for inviting us out to Ann Arbor in the first place. So participatory budgeting, it is a mouthful. We like to call it PB for short. It started in 1989 in Brazil, and it's basically a democratic process in which residents directly decide how to spend part of a city's budget. It came to Cambridge in 2014 from one of our city councilors. He had some experience with PB in Portugal and wanted to see if the city could implement it. We're now in our third year. We're up to $700,000 that residents are deciding which capital projects I'd like to implement.
So this is not the entire budget. This is a portion of the budget.
It's a portion of our capital budget. So it goes into infrastructure projects and different things people want to see around town, yes.
So why do this? I mean, we elect city council members to brush up on, do their homework, find out what the priorities for the city should be. Why shouldn't they make the decisions for us then?
Well, I guess in our case, it was a decision by one of the city councils to sort of bring it to the city. But it's about getting people more involved. It's a civic engagement tool. It was trying to get people more involved around budgetary decisions in Cambridge and also getting people to sort of start voting from a younger age. Our voting age for this is 12 years old. And
right.
You also don't have to be a U.S. citizen to vote in this process. So we're trying to make it very open and inclusive and sort of just get people engaged in community and city building.
So how do people who are registered voters and taxpayers feel about people who aren't paying taxes participating and deciding how the money's spent?
Well, we've actually had a very positive response to the whole PB process so far. And even if you don't pay taxes in the city, you still may pay parking tickets, dog licenses, birth certificates. There's many other ways that you contribute to the community besides just using services. It's been really great. Every once in a while, you get someone who says, I don't think 12-year-olds should vote. But when you go to some of the voting events at the schools and our youth centers, you can really see young people engaging thoughtfully about the process. I mean, we're talking about projects that are on city property. So the parks, the playgrounds, the streets, the libraries, the schools, that's where a lot of young people are spending their time. So why not ask them, what they think should be in those spaces?
I was reading an article in Next City written by our friend Anna Clark from a couple of years back. It was looking at Chicago's participatory budgeting process. The 49th Ward there learned a bit of a hard lesson, and that is residents aren't likely to vote for street resurfacing, so they had to change the ballot and were forced to ask the residents, okay, what percentage of funds should go to street resurfacing, because there's going to be something going to them. Are there little kinks in the process that you found in Cambridge? Do you have to worry about those things?
Not something like that. I think we have a pretty big capital budget, so we take care of things like street resurfacing and sewer separation and some of those ideas that may not make it to the top of a PB ballot. We take care of those separately. But the PB ballot has really brought more creative projects that the city might have not thought of to the ballot. So, for instance, last year, one of the winning projects was a freezer van that's going to help with prepared food rescue deliveries. So taking food from places like Harvard University that's not going to be used and freezing it, repackaging it, and bringing it to some of the families and food pantries around the city. So we've gotten, more creative projects. There's going to be a public toilet in one of our main squares that's coming out as part of this process. That's probably one of the most popular projects that's won so far.
Do you mean a public restroom, or do you mean, explain public toilet?
Everyone always wants to know about the toilet. It's actually the Portland Loo, which was designed by Portland, Oregon. It's kind of this stainless steel structure. The city's already put one in a different square. It's big enough for your stroller, your bike, your wheelchair if you need to go in. You can see people's feet on the bottom, right? So you can tell if more than one person was in there, if someone was lying down.
I've seen photos of this.
Yeah. There's been studies done about where Cambridge needs some more public restrooms. So PB is also helping respond to that need. We're also doing things like automated water bottle filler stations, bilingual books for kids learning English, 100 new street trees won the first year. One thing we really liked was that it seems like people are voting for things that help people in need or citywide. Like, you really don't see many folks voting for, this community garden in my area. You know, a lot of people who voted for the public toilet, maybe they're not planning to use it. Or maybe the people who voted for the bilingual books aren't teaching their children Nepali or Hindi or Arabic at home, but thought that these resources would be helpful in the community.
So what's the big picture goal? Why do this?
It's sort of like what I said before, just trying to inspire people to get more involved. It's a great tool for the city to learn what more people care about as well. We're trying really to reach underrepresented groups who may not come out as part of the broader political processes, and that's also kind of why I mentioned that people as young as 12 or people who are not U.S. citizens can participate in this. We're doing an evaluation this year. We do an evaluation every year that focuses more on who voted and who we're reaching. But the evaluation this year will try to gauge the impact of PB now that it's been 3 years to see sort of, is it changing people, the way people think about the city, interact in the city? Is it affecting their broader participation in political processes and just civic processes? So we'll see.
As you know, our major city, Detroit, went through bankruptcy. I'm just wondering if you could use this process in reverse, vote on what programs you want the city to cut.
We were talking about that recently to see sort of that might be a way for towns who struggle a bit more financially. Yeah, these hard decisions, you could put it to the community and sort of say, we need to make cuts somewhere. Here's, you know, seven different places. Where do you feel it would hurt the least?
You mentioned a couple of countries that are using this. Are there any states in the United States using this?
Not that I know of, but you're right that it doesn't just have to be a municipality. Other organizations like universities are doing it. Housing authorities are doing it. You could even do it in schools, too. So the real key is just letting people who contribute to an organization, you know, directly decide how to use part of that money. I know when I was in grad school, I had many opinions about how I'd like my tuition dollars to be spent.
Well, I think there's a fair number of people in Michigan who figure they could make better choices than the legislature does. So I can see that happening. Or for that matter, you know, you could take individual agencies of a state,
right,
like the Department of Natural Resources, and where are you going to spend that money? You know, is it going to be spent on keeping the parks open, opening new hunting areas, whatever they might do. I suppose even the private sector, private charities, foundations, mm-hmm, could use something like this to get a better feel for their community and what the needs are.
Right, and I think the key to getting people's participation is that you're putting real money on the table. That's what motivates people to come out and sort of spend the time. People volunteer a lot of time as part of our process. We have about 60, we call them budget delegates, and they're the ones that research all of the ideas that come in. They develop the proposals. They ultimately decide what's on the ballot, but they meet every single week for about 3 months. There's a big volunteer effort, and I think people are willing to come out and spend that kind of time with us because they are making real decisions about real projects.
We've been talking about participatory budgeting, which is something that Cambridge is using. Michelle Monsiger is with the budgeting department in Cambridge. She's here in Michigan talking to IPSI and Ann Arbor folks about the idea and see what they think. So thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This election year has a lot of people scratching their heads. Many just cannot understand why two people who are not that well-liked, according to the polls, are the nominees of the major parties. And Republicans and Democrats just cannot understand how or why the people in the opposite party can think the things they do. There's a new book that looks at how parties and their supporters are different and tries to help make sense of American politics today. The book is Asymmetric Politics. It was written by David Hopkins and Matt Grossman. Matt Grossman joins us now. You wrote, while the Democratic Party is fundamentally a group coalition, the Republican Party can be most accurately characterized as the vehicle of an ideological movement. Break that down for us. What do you mean?
Well, whether you look in the electorate, at the party organizations, or in government, the Democratic Party is organized as a coalition of different demographic and issue groups that have particular policy concerns and want to see new laws enacted to further those interests.
Now, I'm going to stop you just for a second, because that reminds me of the old Will Rogers line, "I am not a member of any organized political party. I am a Democrat." He was right, it sounds like.
Well, it used to be the case that we assumed that that would go with disorganization, that if you had a lot of groups you were trying to pull together, they would be disorganized. But in the last decade or so, we've actually seen that a party that defines itself by principles, the Republican Party, can also have a lot of dissension. And now we have the Democrats, even though they have to line up a lot of groups behind disparate policy agenda, seem to be getting along internally better than the Republican Party.
I want to ask you how the arguments in your books, your view of the voters and the parties, how does that differ from other political science research?
Well, I think we naturally try to come up with theories and analyses of the political parties that treat them at least as somewhat comparable, although they are aiming for different ends, organized similarly to try to achieve those ends. I think that's sort of our baseline. And so we get off track if we're trying to understand one party through the other party's lens. And that's what we're trying to correct with this book.
Tell me, how recently have the Republican Party and Democrat Party evolved into what they are today?
Well, the Republican Party, after the 1964 election, became really the vehicle of the conservative ideological movement. But it took a while to actually get overwhelmingly conservative elected officials in the 1980s. But we're long past that point, where the Republican Party is really unified around the broad cause of conservatism, but they've always had trouble translating that conservatism into actual policy action in government. And in the last decade or so, you've seen a real dissension as Republican leaders are regularly told by their base of supporters that they're really just not living up to the principles that they're campaigning on.
Right. Rhinos.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. On the Democratic side, there remains a group coalition, but the relative sizes of the groups and what they want is changing somewhat over time. Essentially, you have a very racially diverse electorate in the Democratic Party, and slowly that has also become a more diverse elected base of officials. But good news for the Democrats is that that increasing diversity hasn't necessarily coincided with more fights among the groups. There's always conflicts about which policies to pursue first. There's a very broad agenda, but there isn't the same conflict with, say, unions and ethnic groups on different sides of the same issue that there has been in the past.
I want to talk about where the two groups get their information. You note that conservatives, who got tired of liberal media and academia, built their own network of alternative media outlets and think tanks. What's that done for them?
It was always the case that academia and the media had more liberals than conservatives compared to the public, and that Republican elites were more skeptical of those institutions than Democratic elites. But it really took an active agenda to build conservative media and to build conservative think tanks to counter those institutions, and then to translate that elite distrust to the conservative base. Now they have accomplished that, and so conservatives really don't trust either academia or the media and want to rely on more directly and self-consciously conservative alternatives. So it means that Republicans are more likely to live in an information environment in which they're regularly told about this broad ideological conflict over the direction of the country. And Democrats have a diverse array of media sources, but they still trust mainstream media to arbitrate between the parties.
You also say Democrats tend to rely on research at universities while Republicans rely on research out of think tanks. So what's the result of those different approaches?
The result is that you have Republican elites much more reliant on conservative viewpoints that are furthered with their own data and research, but that start from the premise that we should have a smaller government that does less, that we should slow the speed of social change, that we should pursue a nationalistic American foreign policy. So those are sort of baked in to conservative research enterprises, whereas on the Democratic side, you see a much more pragmatic what works for advancing the interests of Democratic constituencies in the research base that they're reliant on.
Okay, let's talk about this election year. Donald Trump is not a typical Republican candidate. His positions don't align with many of the core conservative principles. Some Republicans are not supporting him, but a lot of Republicans and conservatives are supporting Mr. Trump. How do you explain that?
I'd say that it's actually been fairly common that the principles don't necessarily line up with the issue positions. That is, Republicans have long agreed over the broad values that they want to advance. But in the electorate, there's a lot of Republicans who share Donald Trump's issue positions. Even at the organizational base, there is differences of opinion about how to apply conservative values. So what's the same about Donald Trump is he has a very broad message, make America great again, that isn't very dependent on specific policy positions. And that is a usual Republican strategy. But what's different is that there's really been no attempt to talk in your traditional small government language. It's been almost entirely reliant on these other aspects of conservatism that fear social change and that look to American nationalism.
Let's look at the other candidate, or one of the other candidates, I guess I should say. Hillary Clinton has gathered that coalition of Democratic groups, but many supporters of Bernie Sanders are just not on board with her. What's your research tell us about a situation like that?
Well, it's been fairly common that there has been a disproportionately young and white and liberal part of the Democratic coalition that is sort of less satisfied with traditional Democratic officials. They usually lose the primaries because you need more than those young, white, well-educated liberals to win a Democratic primary. Liberals are still a minority of the Democratic coalition, whereas conservatives are a big majority in the Republican coalition. That pattern is fairly typical, but there is some sign that there may be a change on the horizon. Young people are more likely to identify as liberal. They're not afraid of those kinds of terms. So it'll be interesting to see if they maintain those liberal values as they grow older.
As I see it, establishment Republicans did not get the candidate they wanted. Establishment Democrats did. What does that tell you about how politics works in this election year?
That's consistent with voter attitudes. The Republican electorate not only doesn't trust the Democratic president, they don't trust their own Republican leadership in Congress. They think that they've betrayed their principles. It's much more likely on the Republican side that you get a successful candidate running against its own party elites than on the Democratic side, where there's a lot of people mad at the Republican leadership, but not so many Democrats that are upset with their own party leadership.
So what was the main goal of the book? What did you hope to accomplish?
The main goal was to just sort of say we have a fairly obvious set of differences that most people are observing in the political world between the two parties, and yet we have a research base that constantly assumes that the two parties are pretty directly comparable. And so we wanted to try to bring those together, to try to bring the research base down, to make it speak to contemporary politics, and then to sort of raise the discussion of party differences to say what's really at the core of these differences and how we can put them together. We also think that there are important implications for policy. We think that what's happened is there has been a grand compromise of sorts between the parties. We essentially pursue the pragmatic goals of Democratic constituents, but we do it through Republican means. So we keep adding to the tasks of government, but we tend to do it decentralized. We tend to rely on private providers. We tend to rely on the tax code rather than government spending. So all of these conservative critiques of the form of government have been incorporated into our policy process, but we're still expanding the role of government to address those Democratic constituencies.
That's Matt Grossman. The book is Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. It was written by David Hopkins and Matt Grossman. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, Tammy Coxon shows us how to make a sawbuck using a Grand Rapids rye and a Detroit IPA. That's in 15 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. People like cemeteries for a lot of reasons. They connect us to history. They tell stories, sometimes when and about how some people died. They're supposed to last forever and getting taken care of forever. At least that's the idea. But sometimes cemeteries fall on hard times. Sarah Hewlett reports on a Jewish cemetery on Detroit's East Side that was nearly abandoned and the guy who's trying to keep it from crumbling.
David Goldman isn't even from Detroit. He's a Chicago guy.
Oh, this is the one that I meant to glue up. I got to bring some putty.
We're at B'nai David Cemetery, and Goldman just picked up a photograph encased in a glass ball that's fallen off one of the headstones. This is a small, modest graveyard that sits up on a hill. You could easily miss it driving by on Van Dyke. The gravestones are carved in Hebrew, Yiddish, and English. A few years ago, you wouldn't even have been able to see some of them. The weeds had grown so high. Goldman walks over to a grave near the back of the cemetery.
So this is my wife's great-grandmother.
Esther Malkashevovich died in 1918, along with a lot of other people, during the flu pandemic. Goldman says for a number of years after he moved here, he'd visit this grave with his in-laws.
And over the years, we saw the progressive decay of this place, and maybe 4 years ago when we came, it really had hit rock bottom. The grass was higher than the headstones, and it just was a mess.
And the neighborhood wasn't doing too great either. Lisher Cooper was the groundskeeper here in the 90s. For a while, she lived in the caretaker's house that sat on the property. It's gone now. It was used as a drug house and ruined. Cooper says eventually fewer and fewer people came to visit their relatives.
I guess they was afraid because the hookers used to run up and down the street. I chased them across the street.
By the mid-90s, the synagogue that ran the cemetery, B'nai David, had fewer and fewer members and eventually quit holding services. It also used the money from the cemetery's perpetual care fund to try to stay afloat. So the grass grew over the stones, and the gates were only opened a couple times a year. On one of those days, a few years ago, David Goldman was here with his family. His daughter Eva was coming up on her bat mitzvah, and they figured a cemetery cleanup day might be a good service project.
And that first year, we got almost a couple hundred people, and we cleaned it up and raised enough money to get the grass cut.
They started doing the cleanups a couple times a year. Goldman tracked down the burial records and had an online map created. People call him up, looking for their relatives. Not too long ago, he got a call from the Droz family. Gary, Allen, and Ken are brothers. They were trying to track down the grave of an uncle who died long before any of them were born.
He died when he was two.
This is Gary.
And my dad mentioned that he had a little brother that died, but we didn't know that he was in this cemetery till my brother was doing some genealogy research.
But David Goldman didn't have a Droz in his records. Turns out, whoever carved the gravestone spelled the name wrong. It's a B instead of a D. Once they solved the mystery, the brothers came to find the grave.
See, it's faded on this side, but this you can clearly see, B-R-O-Z, Edwin, 1926, age 2.
And we think he died at or near his birthday.
That's Ken there. Instead of celebrating their son's birthday, his grandparents buried their 2-year-old boy under a stone with the wrong name. For David Goldman, these connections to the past are important. He says that's why he does this.
For me, it's about history, and it's about respecting those who sacrificed and came before us. And I don't know, I feel a strong pull to sort of pay regards and teach my own children, at least, the importance of those who came before us and that we should honor that in some way.
The city of Detroit may soon honor the history of B'nai David, too. A proposal to declare the site an historic district could see a vote before the end of the year. I'm Sarah Hewlett, Michigan Radio News.
Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes from, in part, from the grant of the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. recently spoke with Kalamazoo Commissioner Matt Malzarek, who has some reservations about a $70 million gift and future private funds to help pay for city services. It's called Foundation for Excellence. Malzarek is concerned about whether the city government should be so reliant on private donations and whether city employees would feel answerable to the people and their elected representatives or to the wealthy donors on whom the city might depend. Other commission members support accepting the gift and the additional hundreds of millions of dollars to follow. David Anderson is one of them, and he joins us now. So what's your response to Commissioner Milzerich's concerns?
I would like to frame this, and I recognize that whenever, you know, change is proposed, there's a natural human resistance to the idea of that. I think that's very natural. I think we're also living in a time when there's serious mistrust of institutions, you know, general suspicion and cynicism. So I get that. But what I really want to do here is just for a second, you know, before we jump into the questions, is just pause for a moment and take a breath and basically recognize that we have the opportunity to take advantage of some serious, serious generosity combined with good intentions that I think really is profound in a couple ways. One, it is really a public recognition of our history of neglect for our urban centers. And that is something that's been happening in the nation for decades now. We're experiencing the results of it here in Michigan, maybe more so than other places.
And I think that's part of the concern here, that government is abdicating its role and private sectors are stepping in. And that's the larger concern. This just gives, you know, hey, if Kalamazoo can do it, any city could do it. Just go get your local billionaire and have them dump some money into a foundation for you. And that way the state and the feds don't have to come up with the kind of revenue sharing or grants that they once did.
I appreciate that concern. I can tell you that when it comes to both sides of the aisle here, in the entire time I've been in the city commission, that we have seen diminished resources from the state and the feds every single year. I do not think that by having some help, this is not going to solve everything, a be-all and end-all. This is the time for us to stand up and say in our local communities, this experiment, we cannot sit around here, real lives are being affected, and hold our breath and hoping someone's going to come riding on a white horse. I mean, I think if we're expecting the feds to do that anytime soon, we are really not living in reality. And so we are still very much working with the MML, advocating for fair distribution of state shared revenue. That is not going to stop. And, you know, here it is coming up again, a conversation about, crushing college debt. All right, well, there was something very unique proposed in Kalamazoo that people still, as a matter of fact, in some cases say negative things about, the Kalamazoo Promise, 11 years going now. Guess what? That problem of crushing college debt has been addressed here in Kalamazoo. And it is oftentimes where local communities come together and solve their own problems by people who are committed to those communities.
But you have to admit...
I want to go on just for a second.
No, hang on. You have to admit that this is an outlier. We're not talking about providing scholarships or money for kids to go to school. We're talking about providing basic city services. That's different.
That is different. And here is the great thing about it, Lester, is that this recognizes in a very, very public way. I'm not in any way equating it to the Kalamazoo Promise. I'm talking about it as similarities, is that we are recognizing that cities are being starved, and local folks are noting that, and this in no way relieves anyone from the responsibility of doing that. This is not going to solve our problems. Part of the strategy here, and the reason we're talking about reducing property taxes as part of this package, the proposal came from the city side, is because we are one of the highest tax communities in the state of Michigan, and that is a real hurdle to get over when we need additional investment. And we're hoping that that's going to make that horse stronger, you know, in terms of our property tax revenue. In addition to that, you know, we're talking about, you know, undue influence or that sort of thing. Do you think that Detroit would have been bailed out of bankruptcy without...
Well, you're talking about a smaller town and a lot more money than Detroit got in the grand bargain, if that's what you're talking about, that's what you're referring to.
$850 million in Detroit. Look at all the money that's going to Flint right now. Do we want to spend our money after horrible things have happened like Flint? or do we, are we looking for folks, community partners, to step forward and help where they live? In my estimation, whether we like it or not, we are heading into an age of philanthropy, driven in many ways by the way that there's been a disparate effect for how wealth has accumulated due to technology, due to globalization. And we're starting to look at whether it's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, whether it's Warren Buffett, whether it's Chan Zuckerberg, now beginning to commit more and more to contribute back into that public sphere. And I think that as imperfect as it may be.
That's all well and good if you happen to be Kalamazoo and be getting that kind of money, but not every little village or city or even larger city is going to get a local billionaire to offer this kind of money. This sets us up in a way that government is not taking responsibility, or local government officials aren't pressuring their state representatives and state senators to fix the revenue sharing issue that the state is experiencing.
Well, we are not giving up on that pressure. We've been applying that pressure now for years, and I hope to heck that we benefit from that. But let's look at the cities that happen to be doing well around the state. Let's look at Holland. Let's look at Grand Rapids. Right now, Art Prize is going in Grand Rapids. Philanthropic funding, 100%. You're right, it isn't going into streets, but make no doubt, you know, have no doubt that that is not an economic development initiative. In those cases, and here's the profound thing about this, Lester, is that we see philanthropy intertwined with public life since the day this country was founded. Just so far in 2016, there's been over 500 commitments of resources, $1 million or more, from one end of this country to the other. And most of the time, it's to a new chemistry building at a school, or maybe to a park, or maybe to a hospital. In this case, and I think this is very important, it is really providing the responsibility to the duly elected local representatives to make their own choices about how this money is best spent. You know, was the best thing for us to have an art prize here in Kalamazoo? Well, a philanthropist certainly could have funded that. But the philanthropist is basically saying, here's how I can help. Lester, I live across the street from Kalamazoo Public School. It has 98% free and reduced lunch. And every day I see community members, including students from local colleges and universities, walking in there to do their part to help system change. This is a huge thing that has to happen. And it just so happens that there are some people with some wherewithal here who are contributing in the way that they can, taking their hands off and saying, you know, this, do good work, make sure that low-income individuals, 36% of the folks who live in the city of Kalamazoo, poverty level or below, do those folks deserve to have paved streets, public parks, good policing? You betcha they do. And we can question this model, and I'm still thinking we're underfunded, and government that we all participate in needs to step up. But it is unfair to say we're going to stay victims. We're going to let kids suffer. You know, we're going to let kids that walk to school right across the street from me, you know, walk on sidewalks that mothers come and beg us to fix, and we don't have any money in our budget, pass houses that have been boarded up for years, pass blight, because, you know, we're going to take some higher road to make a point. And I think in this
let me get to one thing, because there's one question you haven't answered that I brought up at the beginning, and that's whether city employees will feel answerable to the people or their elected representatives or to these wealthy donors. And that question you haven't addressed.
Well, let me address that directly. First of all, there's an entire construct set up for that. If I'm looking at adjacent, jurisdictions to Kalamazoo, let's talk about Battle Creek, Kellogg's in Battle Creek. Let's talk about Portage, just south of us. Pfizer, the largest manufacturing facility for Pfizer, is in Portage. Let's talk about Covert Township, just west of us. More than 50% of their total township property taxes comes from one business entity. So there are certainly structures right now, if you're going to talk about do people feel owing to something or other, where we have governments that are very, very dependent on local businesses who pay large, large property taxes. So there's ways to deal with that. One way is to be transparent. And I think that that is something we're entirely going to do with this in terms of constructing how this will be spent and how decisions will be made. And I think it's, you know, we will not have a problem with that.
What's the timeline for making a decision on how this will all work and accepting this, the Foundation for Excellence?
As I understand at this point, we are hoping before October is over in one of our regular business meetings to, in essence, approve what is described as a Memorandum of Understanding, an MOU, which really lays out in more general ways what we've been discussing here in terms of how it might work, the functioning of it. Then the details for how this will be continue to be transparent, carefully managed, and then one of the resources that is available to Kalamazoo for Kalamazoo citizens to hopefully, you know, raise the bar on quality of life for everyone here in town.
David Anderson is a Kalamazoo City Commissioner and supports the idea of the Foundation for Excellence, which would be an original $70 million bridge gift that is to span 3 years and then funds anywhere from $300 to $500 million after that to help offset the functions of Kalamazoo City. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
If you miss any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast to find the link.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
We're here to find out about another cocktail from Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. What do you have for us this time?
Well, I was listening to Michigan Radio, and I heard about this beer tax that's being debated.
Right. It's being proposed. 5 cents on a bottle, and I don't remember how much for a keg.
I think it's over $20. And in fact, that has a little something to do with the cocktail we're going to do today.
And what is it?
This drink's called the Sawbuck.
Oh, Sawbuck. That's like 10 bucks, right?
Right. And two of these won't even pay the tax on a keg of beer.
Okay. So what's in this? Is there beer?
There is beer. So this is a rye cocktail. So it starts with rye whiskey, an ounce of it, and then it has half an ounce of cinnamon-infused simple syrup, a quarter ounce of a walnut-flavored liqueur called Nux Alpina, although you could substitute a couple dashes of black walnut bitters. And then it has half an ounce of lemon juice. We shake that all up and add 3 ounces of the Corktown Rye IPA from Atwater Brewery in Detroit.
And what kind of rye did you use?
Today I used the Long Road Distillers Rye. They're out of Grand Rapids. We heard about them last time, and I just got to taste their rye whiskey, and I really liked it, so I put it in today.
All right, I'm going to give a taste of the Sawbuck. That very much reminds me of fall.
Absolutely. So yeah, not only is this pertinent to the tax at question, but it's also just a great drink for the season. Cinnamon, really nice, deep, dark flavors. Great for sitting by the fire on these cold, rainy days like we're having today.
Well, thanks very much.
Cheers.
You know, when I got back to the radio station, I realized we said kegs when we should have said barrels. There are two kegs in a barrel. So a Sawbuck would just about pay the tax on a keg if the legislature passes this 244% increase in the beer tax. Last I heard, there wasn't much of a chance of that, but hey, during lame duck session, who knows? That's Stateside for today. I'm Lester Graham. Have a nice weekend.